Welcome to the Cold Steel Podcast, hosted by Amir Farouk and myself, Chad Ball. We consider it an absolute privilege to bring you guests from around the world who are truly experts in their craft. Our mission is to offer you a combination of not only masterclasses on clinical surgery topics, but also insights into achieving personal growth, productivity, and fulfillment as both a surgeon and perhaps more importantly, as a human.
Dr. Jonathan Meekins is a former chair of the Department of Surgery at McGill. He is also an officer of the Order of Canada for his outstanding work in immunobiology, laparoscopic surgery, and transplantation. Among his many interests is his love of art, and at the age of 73, Dr. Meekins has gone back to school to obtain his master's in fine arts. Check out the show notes to see some of the fascinating work Dr. Meekins has done to demonstrate how the critical viewing of art can perhaps make us better clinicians.
Can you tell us about where you grew up and where you did your training, sir?
I basically grew up in Montreal. I was fortunate enough to go to largely private schools. One of them was a boarding school, which I don't recommend. I then went to do a bachelor's degree at McGill. And as you may have discovered, I have a long, strong family history of doctors here at McGill. And so I opted to go to medical school at Western. And I think for my personal growth and development, that was a very good decision on my part. And I have no regrets at all to leaving Montreal and not having a McGill degree. My surgical training was entirely at the Royal Victoria. And at that time, McGill was much like Alberta and Edmonton and Calgary. Edmonton and Calgary were competitors, and in Montreal, the Montreal General and the Royal Victoria were competitors and ran, despite being in the same institution, two completely different residency programs with no overlap. So I had the misfortune of never training or experiencing surgery at the Montreal General. They, in fact, had outstanding surgeons, and it's hard to imagine that that wouldn't have been beneficial. However, it was not the culture at the time. In the middle of my residency, a little bit to the annoyance of Dr. McLean, but fundamentally with his support, I went to the States to do a doctorate in Cincinnati in surgical infection and surgical immunobiology. And that thesis and that those 3 years were basically the intellectual infrastructure, or what I like to call intellectual capital, which you require to develop a laboratory. And when I came back and finished my residency at the Royal Victoria and came on staff again at the Royal Victoria and McGill University, my thesis was basically the foundation of my first MRC grant. In those days, you would get a grant for 2 years, and you could then renew it. But the renewals were usually for only a single year until you got a program grant, which we eventually... So my first grant was in 1975, and we eventually got, after two renewals, and an annual renewal is really tiresome, but we got a program grant in 1979 or 80, which continued into the middle 90s, not run by me the entire time. Dr. Christou, who was a colleague in the lab, eventually took it over when I became a chairman in 1989. I might add that training doesn't actually stop the day you leave your residency. most of us think it does or did then. But in fact, training is an ongoing process that continues. And those of you who've grown up in the modern technology era will understand very clearly that you're retraining yourself with every new set of instruments. Laparoscopy has made enormous demands on retraining and so on. And I've taken repeated sabbaticals within that framework of re-education.
Sir, you've had a storied and a well-known career. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention for our listeners that you've won an Order of Canada. Your career has just been full of so many things. You've written a number of textbooks. But if I could ask you, sir, what have been the things that you're most proud of over your career? What are the things that you look back on and really now look at and think that these are the things that I'm most proud of?
It's the first time I've actually had to think about that in concrete terms. It would be silly of me to say that I wasn't delighted to be an officer of the Order of Canada or to have received honorary degrees from McGill and Western. And they were in a form highlights, but they were a function of other activities that were of significance. And I guess I tried to put some of that into some context, but I would have to say that developing a model of surgical infection, which integrated using Venn diagrams, the bacterial component or the infectious component, the environment that was the patient in which the infection took place, and then the host immune response into an integrated approach to the management and study of surgical infections, I thought was a very constructive way of looking at that problem, and was the source of innumerable ways of thinking about the overall problems of surgical infection, so that when one area didn't work out terribly well, you always had two other areas in which you had irons in the fire to work on. Starting with laparoscopy, we established from the very first case at McGill a registry and then established a randomized controlled trial, which we eventually had to terminate because of lack of equipoise. But those two studies led to papers in The Lancet and innumerable papers presented at the American Surgical and throughout Canada, the United States, on the issues associated with laparoscopic surgery. And that basically was integrated with the whole concept of how do you deal with a new procedure? How do you evaluate it? And how do you start to identify what is a good new operation versus what is simply marketing? And being a little, not being very unfair, but there are a number of gradations in between. And that led to a number of discussions and papers on should the rules of evidence be altered for surgery. And when I was at Oxford, we finally actually had a series of seminars or colloquia at my college in Oxford called the Balliol Colloquia. And we eventually set up three manuscripts, which were published in The Lancet in the fall of 2009, identifying at least a roadmap for management of and evaluation of new procedures, which have been referred to innumerable times over the last 11 years. So I thought that was an important process, but it's interesting, it took a long time to get to that point from 1989 with the beginning of laparoscopy to 2009. That's 20 years of fussing around trying to get at the answer to what is not a simple problem, but a very important approach to new technology, as you'll understand It applies to every single branch of surgery and interventive medicine. The other area that I thought was significant was contributions at the American College of Surgeons, which are sort of subdued within the overall framework of the college. I was on the Board of Regents, was involved in a number of important changes that took place, not the least of which was the establishment of a division of education and an outcomes division, which now most of them are flourishing. I would say also that sabbaticals are invaluable in terms of personal development, and they made a huge difference to me in terms of growth and development of myself as an individual, but also in terms of what I was able to bring back to the department.
There's a couple of topics there I was hoping we could drill down on, though, if you're okay with it. The first, you know, obviously your Lancet papers with regard to the introduction of novel technologies, particularly in surgery, but in medicine as a whole, are really the standard bearers. And your experience at Oxford certainly sounds like it was amazing over what I believe was about 6 years. So I'm curious, you know, what that experience was like, firstly, and then secondarily, what drove you to pursue that particular award and preceding competition? And then finally, Gitter, why at that point in your career? So why not earlier or potentially later? Hoping you could frame that, yeah.
Yeah, I can, actually. I think the key word is competing for the position. In fact, I was 62 when it came along, and I spent 6 months at Oxford on sabbatical in Peter Morris's department. And he was at the edge of retirement, and they had not yet completed the selection process. It had fallen behind seriously from an administrative point of view, and they were suddenly finding themselves offering the position as Peter Morris was leaving to someone who eventually turned it down. Now, while I was there, I spent a lot of time observing activities, not only within the hospital, but within, curiously, the examination system. And I ended up writing two reasonably long reports, which were really thoughtful. Yeah, because you have a guy from North America coming in and criticizing the way in which things are done in Oxford. Well, you can imagine that the receptivity index is low. So they had to be extremely carefully crafted and then almost negotiated to be acceptable. So both of those things took place. I won't go into the details of the examination system because it's not really important. But I wrote a report that they eventually adopted for changing the exam system in the last year. And with respect to how the hospital ran its surgical services, I also wrote a report on that that had to do with how we had made all the changes to day surgery, same day admission, pre-admission clinics, etc., at the Royal Victoria. So I left in the fall of 2001 and came back to my previous position, and which was chair of the department and head of surgery at the McGill University Health Center. And rumors started to circulate that they were having trouble finding someone. And eventually, I was asked if I was interested in the post. So I didn't. So in fact, one of the conditions, I said, sure, of course I'm interested in the post. Nobody at 62, which you picked up on rather cleverly, gets a new job of this sort. They go to 50-year-olds that as a general rule, and even in Europe, they tend to even pick people in their 40s. So they were in a bind, in a way, and they needed somebody who had hospital experience as well as university administrative management experience. And there are not a huge number of people around like that who are movable, because they usually have already arrived at a job they like. But I'd been in post at the Royal Victoria for, I don't know, 13 years. And it was my second term as chairman of the Department of Surgery. And you sort of run out of gas in your, in wherever you're working. The concept of 5 years renewable once is a very sound one. And the University of Montreal actually uses 4 years renewable once, on the principle that once you've got to the end of 8 or 10 years, your agenda has, what you can get done has been done, and all the problems you can't solve, you still can't solve tomorrow. And maybe it's time for someone else who can come in and solve the things you can't solve and bring in some fresh ideas. So I was kind of, I don't say I was floundering, because we were making some progress here and there, but fundamentally the opportunity to go to Oxford was terrific. So they asked if I was interested, and I said, yes, I'm interested, but I won't compete for the position. So you either offer me the job or you don't. And the system they have there is called, they have an electoral board, have 9 people, 4 from the Division of Medical Sciences, a chair, 2 people from the college which you would be expected to join, and 2 outsiders from, in this instance, 1 from London and 1 from the north. At any rate, I got a phone call in June of that summer saying that I'd been elected. And so I knew it was going to happen. And my wife and I went to Oxford in the middle of June, and again in the middle of July, to negotiate my own terms and those for my wife's job, all of which got done satisfactorily. And so we moved on very short notice. I mean, it was the opportunity of a lifetime, to be quite honest. It's a wonderful place to live and work. The atmosphere, the environment, the architecture, the history, it was a tremendous opportunity. And while there were a number of lumps and bumps getting along as a North American with an English mindset, and to say that the English surgical community was pleased that a senior Canadian surgeon had got this job, I think would be an understatement, overstatement. There was some lumpy times with the rest of the surgical community, but life goes on. And it was a great experience. I cut a few, you have to cut all your connections with North America. So with the United States and its various societies, plus Canadian structures. But I would, we'd do it again. Both of us had a wonderful time. And I think there was some genuine intellectual and academic productivity, both within the department, the university, and in our own lives. And that innovation study was fantastic, I think. So I think that addresses your question. It was an opportunity that I couldn't turn down, even though it came with a lot of lumps and bumps. You know, we had to sell our house. We had to figure out what to do with the farm. We moved to a new country. Didn't have any idea where we were going to live. It was very exciting. Fantastic thing to happen at the age of 62.
We wanted to ask you a little bit about another passion in your life, and I don't know how you managed to pursue all these different passions within, you know, a 24-hour period. But, you know, you've had a long fascination and love for art. What is it about art that you enjoy learning about and studying about and pursuing so much?
I think, frankly, I was introduced at a very young age. I was taken with my sisters repeatedly to the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts as a child. I don't know when it started, but certainly up until my early teens, I would go. They would be family adventures on the weekend. And then I had 8 weeks in a schoolboy trip in Europe, riding around in a minibus, six of us, with a teacher and his wife. And we went to really the major cities of the UK, Ireland, Paris, Amsterdam. And while it was in city, obviously the museums and cultural activities were significant. And the same in London. There's so much to see and do in London. And we went to Stratford, got introduced to Shakespeare in a real sense, that is, seeing it. Opera, theater. It was a sort of a transformative experience, such that at 21, when I graduated with a BA, even though I didn't know which medical school I was going to, I applied late. So it was in the middle of the summer when my final acceptance came in. But anyway, I just couldn't see not going on this 3-month mini sabbatical. I look back on it now. I didn't think of it that way then. I thought of it just as 3 months in Europe on a scooter. Fantastic. So we did that. I did that and basically went from London to Gibraltar to Florence and Rome and back to Amsterdam and London. So that was quite an adventure. It took us 3 months, And I did the same thing again between third and fourth year in medical school. Most of my classmates all went to be interns or work with people they wanted to have as have a residency with, etc. And I went to Europe for 3 months. Best thing I ever did, or second best thing. I picked a very good wife. That's the best thing I did. At any rate, that concept of taking time off and exercising my brain in different ways, I think, is a part of the way I grew up, but it certainly reaffirmed my interest in going to museums and seeing art. And if there was one thing that happened in those two sets of images I can still recount, one is that as a very young boy seeing Goya's Disasters of War, a set of prints that are horrific in terms of their the war they portray, but also intensely moving and fascinating. And then the landscapes that I saw in London of Constable, Turner, and Gainsborough, along with those in Holland, of Van Rysdale, de Montfort, the two Van Rysdales, and to some extent the Rembrandt's landscapes. They just seemed to touch me one way or another, and remained an interest, and remain still an interest today, those particular artists. So when we took our sabbatical in 1980-81, one of the things we did a lot of was go to antique stores, art galleries, museums, to try and see whether there was something that we might want to collect. And when the dust all settled, it really turned out to be works on paper, stimulated by an extraordinary exhibit we saw of Pizarro, where his print or half of his print output was exhibited. And suddenly we wanted to collect, or I wanted to collect, and we eventually settled on prints and collected or accumulated prints for a wide, long period of time. And you asked, how do you do that in a, fit it into a day? Well, you look at catalogs for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour before you go to sleep at night. I never watched TV. I always thought that if I read the newspaper, I could turn the page, whereas when you're watching TV, it's a lot harder to turn a page because they're setting the agenda. And I never quite cared for that, the concept of the CBC or ABC or NBC setting my intellectual or informative agenda. So newspapers were my source of news. I found by that time I found sports on TV boring. And so this was just a way of exercising my mind, I guess. And it hasn't stopped. The art side of things, I should say.
That's tremendous, Dr. Meekins. I particularly love, you know, this idea that in some ways art is very different than other forms of media, because really there is some onus on the person, the viewer, to actually do some work in terms of actually interpreting what they're seeing. It's not just, you know, a one-way sort of traffic from the TV screen or the computer screen, so to speak, to your mind. Very good. And you know, sort of along those lines, you wrote this really interesting piece in CMAJ. After there was this article written about one of the pieces of art in the hospital, and you sort of wrote a rebuttal about the art collection at McGill. And I'm curious, and I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about it, because I think it gets at some of the interesting kind of thoughts about, like, well, what should art in the hospital or in medicine really look like?
Well, that's a very good question. So let me tell you how I got started on this. The hospitals were going to move, and no one was thinking about what are they going to do with the heritage items or the art that was already in the Royal Victoria and the Montreal Children's Hospitals, to a lesser extent, the chest. So without going into the details, the CEO was persuaded that he needed to set up some kind of group to manage all of this work. How do they transfer? Where does it go? How does it get organized and cataloged? Well, we did that sort of well. It's very difficult. Imagine emptying your own house and knowing where everything is, and then translate that into emptying a hospital that was built 120 years before you're moving. So it was a challenging task, and I don't think we got it all right. But what we have persuaded the CEO and the hospital is that we have to rehang those pictures, that we need to create an environment that is humanistic, that has a distraction quality for patients' family, and actually, I often think more importantly, the staff. So I'm quite persuaded that the art that we've put up at the Glen and the Montreal General have transformed the experience of people who are looked after in the areas where the art is into something more positive than it would have been otherwise, and that the workers in those areas are simply more contented with their environment. Now, imagine that a new building that has nothing in it from a distraction point of view other than the things you have outside people's rooms with disinfectants, masks, gloves, gowns, etc. It could be said to be ugly. And putting color on the walls of quality really transforms that environment extraordinarily. And so we have worked with artists. We've worked with the collection that came out of the Royal Victoria and the Children's to rehang a lot of that work. It's taken quite a bit of discussion with the owners of the hospital. The hospital is not owned either by the government or McGill. It's owned by SNC-Lavalin because it's a private-public partnership. And part of the deal is that the hospital is rented by SNC for a period of 30 years when then it reverts to ownership by McGill, I assume. At any rate, SNC was for a long time disinterested in the idea of putting pictures on the wall. They saw it as nice white, and that it was annoying to have these people wanting to hang things. The nails might go into a pipe or disrupt something else or wouldn't be done appropriately, etc. So it took us a couple of years to really develop a warm relationship with SNC, which exists now. So when we make an application that we want to put up 15 or 20 pictures in a clinic or in a ward, we can provide them using computer technology with the exact location of the pictures. They review what's in the walls and then will approve either our design or make modifications, and we will then go ahead and put the pictures up. So we've had a number of artists who've volunteered or said they wish to donate work, and we have an acquisition committee and an acquisition process, which is quite rigorous, to ensure that I don't paint, but anything that I might draw is not going to get hung on the walls, or no doctor's wife, because, or husband for that matter, who thinks they're an artist is going to get their works automatically placed on the wall, which we knew had happened in the past. Same goes for photographs. We all think we're good photographers, but if you talk to a professional photographer or look at how they take pictures and what they do with their negatives, et cetera, you see that there's a sea order difference in the quality of the image as well as its aesthetic component. I just use Ed Bertinsky or Jeff Wall as perfect Canadian examples. Yusuf Karsh for portraits, extraordinary. And we all think we take good pictures, but the fact is that it's the pros who really take the good pictures. So that was one thing that we did, is using the old material plus new material that artists submitted. Plus we had a series of exhibitions in the research atrium. There's room for 12 very large images, and we've had a drawing exhibit, a couple of photographic exhibits, two painting exhibits. And the issue is that if it's a single artist, the artist has the exhibit for 6 months and then gives us one of the pictures. One of the artists actually gave us two of his paintings. Otherwise, we get one of those, and then it gets moved into a high-profile area within the hospital where lots of people get to see it. Now, that's a long-term process, but we also have photographers and printmakers coming to us with an idea or a set of images, which goes through our acquisition committee. We have rejected material, but that's just sort of life. And then we get to hang it in the clinics, in the corridors. We've done a number of wall wraps with sociocultural issues. We have a lot of material. It would take me well over an hour, maybe 2 hours, to walk you through all of the areas where we've hung artwork. Not only do artists donate, but owners donate. And there we have to be quite a bit more careful. But in our Department of Radiology, for example, there are 60 images, lithographs, and etchings by a single artist. So there's a real coherence to the artwork that's in that area that transforms the walls. It transforms the space. It means you're not in some kind of hostile environment, that it has images that create sort of a human environment. And we think it's working. So we have heritage objectives, we have exhibition cabinets in which we're placing antique instruments and old cutlery and the crockery that used to be used at the Royal Victoria. You'd be amazed at the quality of that material. We'd all be very happy to be eating off it today.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And it's clearly a program that you're obviously passionate, you know, in, and I can certainly see the benefits of it. I think Amir and I both compare and contrast, you know, your program to what we have locally here, which is, you know, really the opposite end of the spectrum. And you're right, with that kind of consideration and care, I have no doubt it invites a quality of artistic endeavor and delivery that, you know, besuits that effort and really does change the environment. To that end, I was hoping you could also talk about the Archives of Surgery paper you wrote in 96 on surgical infections in art. There's a lot of messages in that manuscript, and I love it. We're going to link it to the podcast here so the listeners can all be sure they read it. But you did make a specific comment towards the end of it, I think, where you said something of learning to see what we look at also makes us better clinicians. And I was curious what you meant by that and really how that piece of language articulates really the greater intention of the whole archives paper.
I think part of I got started on that because I knew a curator whose brother was a doctor, and we had a little visit from the University of Michigan history group in medicine. And so Fritz Dupart gave this little talk about images that he knew of where there was a disease evident. And of course, artists are frequently just painting what they see. They're not clinicians, although on occasion you can find situations where the artist must have known what was going on. So the best example, I'd suggest that you look up a painting or either a painting or etching by Giuseppe de Ribera, R-I-B-E-R-A, called Drunken Silenus, S-I-L-E-N-U-S. And what you'll see there is a drunk, but you'll also see the manifestations of advanced cirrhosis with ascites, certain amount of hairlessness, obesity, swollen legs, and gynecomastia, all of which are classic signs of ascites. Now, that may be just transforming what he saw when he painted an old drunk, but it may also reflect in sight on his part. So anyway, I in that sabbatical in 1987, 88, I'd been to this lecture this fellow gave. And we went to We went to museums all the time during that year. And one of the things I looked for was evidence of medical issues in every painting that we looked at. So that you could break it down into things like trauma, injuries, skin diseases, eye diseases, deformed limbs, dwarfs, other structural things. And every once in a while, I'd see an infectious problem. And in that paper, I think I show a picture by Bazile of Claude Monet with streptococcal cellulitis on his leg. But at any rate, the idea is that if you see if you see what you're looking at, you're clearly being a good observer, and that a significant component of clinical medicine is simply looking at your patient. I remember as a medical student, a professor of medicine came in and said, the physical exam starts as the patient walks in the room. And of course, being young and really smart, I said, that's ridiculous. Until I actually had an office and watched people come in the room. And you're assessing them up. How do they look? How do they feel? What's their body stature? What body language are you getting from them? The more you think about that, the more cues you pick up concerning the patient's concern, what kind of a person they are, how they're likely to respond to your recommendations, etc. So observation, I think, is really key. But if you're looking and not absorbing it or not taking it in or actually not seeing it, it's like hearing and listening. You can hear what's going on, but if you're not listening, you're not going to get what the patient's trying to tell you. And the concept is very much the same as looking at people but actually seeing whatever subtle messages they might be trying to convey, or not, they're not trying to, but that's actually what's going on. So, that's part of what that's all about. And I became such a strong believer in that sort of thing that I think you walk into a patient's room and you look at them and you look at the urine bag and you look at the eye drip and the patient's face lying in bed and what their attitude is, pick up a huge amount of information just by walking from the door to the bed. And so that's what I mean by the value of observation, and that if you train yourself that way, you will be a better clinician because you're integrating constantly what's happening. You're turning your interaction into much more than a 3-hour. I've given a talk based on that lecture for infection, but also for all subject art and medicine, and have challenged clinicians in the room to tell me what's wrong with this patient, this subject or that subject. And I've used it for medical students to make the point about observation as well. In other words, they all can look at something and not see that the man in the painting has severe arthritis of the knee or has a squint with a wandering eye or has cancer of the breast or a dislocated shoulder or torn biceps, etc. All of that stuff's there if you're actually integrating the whole image into yours. So I found it very useful to show to even advanced clinicians who don't always get the test, but who find that there's something to be said for enhancing their capacity as observers.
We ask almost all of our guests to go back in time and take them back to the time when they were residents or perhaps early attendings. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself?
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting way to phrase the question. Whereas normally it would be, what would you give advice to other people about? But what I'm going to say actually is I think what I sort of did, but certainly would articulate to residents and medical students who would come by for counseling. It's amazing how many came to ask, what should they do? And of course, you have no idea what they should do. And getting them to crystallize their thoughts about that was quite important. But as I thought about that, the question I asked, and I don't know, I still think it would have been useful if someone had asked me, but I think I'd already done it, is whose job do you want? Folks seem to have difficulty deciding, do they want to be a community surgeon, a big city surgeon, a country surgeon, an academic surgeon. I did my own thinking about career structure, but I think that that's a very important question as well. What kind of a career do you want? You have to learn to make decisions that are actually not crucial. So what I mean by that is, do you want to be I'm going to go into orthopedics. Well, do you want to be a hand surgeon or a shoulder surgeon or foot ankle surgeon? Well, actually, it doesn't much matter. All you have to do is decide you're going to be one or the other, and then go and be the best you can be. And I don't think that those kinds of questions are asked often enough. But when I thought about this, I really figuring out what I would ask myself. But the most useful thing I found that I ask other people was, whose job do you want? Because if they can do that, and I then translated back, I can now admit it, but if anyone had asked me at that time, whose job did I want? I would have to have said I would like Lloyd McLean's job, which I suppose that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because that's what happened. But they also have to know how to structure a career. And not everybody does know how to do that. And I did come to medicine with a big advantage that I had a grandfather who was head of medicine at the Vic and McGill for, I don't know, 25 years. And so a lot of the issues associated with academic careers kind of filtered down as I was growing up. I have no real recollection of how that happened, but I seem to understand some of the issues even as I was in medical school about how to structure where I wanted to go and what I wanted to be, although there were some right angle turns along the way. There was one other thing that I mentioned earlier, you just have to decide. And the analogy I would use always is, I had a farm and we used to prune our apple trees and other plants. And the fact is that when you trim an apple tree, you come back a year later, you cannot tell which branches you cut off that have allowed the tree to become straight. In other words, if you come to a fork in a tree and you cut this one off, the tree will simply straighten out. And is that you've decided to do something and now you're going to do it. Yogi Berra had an expression, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Now you can interpret that any number of different ways, but it's really the truth. Because it doesn't actually matter which pathway you take, as long as you do the best you can do and are the best you can be.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us @CanJSurge. Thanks again.